the Hermetic Hour for Thursday, February 2nd, 2012. And I'm your host, Pope Runyon. Now, tonight we present a discussion on the life and times of America's most famous and notorious ceremonial magician, John Marvel Whiteside Parsons. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand the secrets of magic, but Jack Parsons actually was a rocket scientist. And he not only established the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, that's NASA's JPL, in Pasadena, he also ran the Agape Lodge of the Ordo Templi Orientis from a mansion on Orange Grove in Pasadena that members called the Ghastly Gables. And it was more commonly known as the Parsonage, after Parsons. Now, Parsons has a lunar crater on the moon named after him. Of course, it's on the dark side. Now, we'll trace Jack's fantastic career from the Depression era years through World War II and on into the post-war era. Our references for this discussion will be John Carter's, and I have a little note here, is that the Warlord of Mars? Well, it is certainly a pseudonym. John Carter's book, Sex and Rockets, which came out in 1999, and our own conversations with Lou Culling, who was a member of the Agape Lodge, and Cameron Parsons, Jack's late wife, and our own 1976 seventh-ray publication of Parsons' essay, Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword. That was the publication. We'll discuss the Babylon working. That's Parsons' most famous magical operation. And the Caltech Drama Department's recent stage play 2 years ago, Pasadena Babylon, which we saw and enjoyed. Now, I said the launch time was 8 p.m. Thursday, and then I ended up with 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, blast off. Read the books on Jack. You know that when he was shooting off these rockets back in the old days at Arroyo Seco, even before JPL was JPL, they were down there in the Arroyo shooting these rockets off, and he'd get out there before they fired the rockets, and he'd do Crowley's Hymn to Pan. And, of course, everybody knew that he was a bit kooky, but they indulged him because, God, he was a brilliant, brilliant scientist. And he was essentially self-educated. Now, Jack, let me tell you a little about this Marvel thing. Jack's father's name was Marvel Parsons. Now, Marvel was a captain in the Army in World War I. And so you might say that little Jack was the son of Captain Marvel. And Captain Marvel named his son Marvel, which his wife, Ruth, didn't like much. And so when they got divorced, Marvel went away and John replaced Marvel. So it was John Whiteside Parsons. So that's how that came about. Yet, in a way, maybe Jack should have stayed with Marvel. I don't know, because he certainly was one. Jack Parsons grew up in Pasadena, and he, his wife's parents were fairly well off, so he grew up with kind of without a father, actually, related to his grandfather. And his mother was very doting and loving. So was kind of a mama's boy, and grew up in a very privileged, very well-off family. So he could indulge his, the fantasies that young kid growing up, you know, and he loved, the Arabian Nights and mythology and all that. So he was very romantic, and yet he had quite a bent for science. And yet, you know, Jack never did get a degree. Everybody thinks that he that he's a Caltech scientist. Actually, he worked at Caltech and worked with that bunch, but he was self-educated primarily, and he really, really was a talented chemist, and, of course, became one of the top rocket scientists in the United States during World War II. He was primarily responsible for developing what was called JATO, jet-assisted takeoff. Actually, the JATO units were rockets. They called them jets because they didn't want to scare the guys in the planes by saying, "We're putting rockets on your plane to blow you up off the runway," and so they called them JATO. But essentially, they were solid fuel rockets, and Jack was primarily responsible for developing them. This, by the way, a lot of people don't remember this too much, but those JATO units really, really helped win the war because they enabled us to get planes off of very, very short runways and some planes off of aircraft carriers that we otherwise couldn't do. So there was a very, very important development. And then, of course, after the war, solid fuel, and we don't realize this, but I mean, solid fuel plays quite a part in space travel, rocketry, too, in the way of boosters and what have you. But Jack also worked with liquid fuel rockets, and they got started out working at Caltech. And as I said, Jack was not a Caltech graduate. He had a few years of college, but he wasn't a Caltech engineer. But he was very much part of that team at Caltech before the war, and they used to shoot off their rockets in Arroyo Seco, which eventually became their headquarters, JPL. At that, it was called Galsit at that time. Jack's partner, Mark Foreman, he and Jack really, really worked hard developing these things with their own money. I mean, they spent a lot of their own money, their own time. I can really relate to this. Because when I was a kid in St. Petersburg, we were doing the same thing. We were going to science fiction. We had a science fiction club, and one of my best friends was one of these guys like Jack that was out there shooting rockets off, and Joe Dabbs, and he ended up on working on von Braun's team, and there was a lot of people really, really doing this kind of thing. Yet Jack and his little group that they referred to over in Caltech as the Suicide Squad, because rocket experiments are kind of dangerous. And Jack, he was always taking chances one thing or another. So anyway, they worked under a very, very prominent scientist, Theodor von Karman. And Theodor von Karman was a Hungarian immigrant who was the head of this department at Caltech, and eventually in JPL. And then eventually they founded a company called Aerojet, which went on to be a huge corporation. So this was Jack's his profession. And this was where his talent lay, and he had several patents, and he was, as I say, he was the father of both the JATO unit and one of the main founders of what became JPL. In fact, some people jokingly call JPL Jack Parsons Laboratories. Now, that's the career side of Jack Parsons, uh-huh. Well, now, Jack also, along with being a terrific rocket scientist, Jack was also a very handsome and a very dynamic person. And from being a kind of an introverted mama's boy as a kid, he grew up, he was one good-looking dude, and looked like a star, and he became very interested in and through science fiction, of course, he became very interested in the occult, and he ran across a book by Crowley, and this was back before, right before World War II, and he got me very, very interested in Crowley, and he started writing Crowley, just based upon giving him a copy of Knox on Pox. He started writing Crowley, and he thought, this is it. Now, Jack was very anti-Christian. He was raised in a Christian, but he was very anti-Christian and very much against all of the prudity and the restrictions of Christianity and the imposition of all the blue laws and all that sort of thing. Jack was against that, and he was essentially a pagan, and so Crowley's philosophy just resonated with him right down the line, and unfortunately his colleague Frank Molina, Molina and Foreman and Parsons, Molina, unfortunately, his particular bent. In the Suicide Squad, and Molina's particular bent was communism, and Molina was ardently communist. Jack was only left wing just to the degree that it indicated personal freedom and whatever, and rebellion against the restrictive aspects of a capitalist society. That's the only thing that interested Jack. He wasn't really an ardent communist, but Molina was. And Molina, of course, attended communist meetings and all this, which wasn't too good, especially getting into World War II. Although, you remember, in World War II, we were allied with the Russians, so it wasn't quite so bad as it ended up being in the Cold War. When the Cold War started, this is when his association with Molina, Jack's association with Molina, came back to bite him. After that, during the McCarthy era, but we'll get into that later. Anyway, Jack was, as I say, basically an ardent pagan. Now, another thing about Jack we should point out, that he was very, very, very much into Crowley, and he met through his Crowley connections, he met Wilford Smith, and Wilford Smith was an older man, an Englishman, who had been running the OTO Lodge on Winona Boulevard in Las Feliz area in Los Angeles back in the 30s. Now, there was a scandal. I'm not going to get into that too much, but there was a big scandal that blew up the Winona Lodge back before Jack got interested in this. So Wilford Smith had kind of been into retirement after this scandal. I remember my ex-wife once said that the OTO establishes its identity with its scandals. Well, they used to do that, actually. So you have a scandal, and then they'd go underground, and then they'd come back, you know. Well, anyway, so Smith was kind of in licking his wounds and in retirement after this scandal. And so Jack got interested in during the war, in the 40s, early 40s, and he got interested in Crowley. And so he got together with Smith, got Smith out of retirement, brought Smith in as his high priest and as to teach him how to do the Gnostic Mass and all the rest of that stuff. They got a mansion on Orange Grove in Pasadena, right down near where the Rose Parade headquarters is. This is Millionaire's Row on Pasadena's big estates. And this really, really big place. It had about 19 bedrooms, and it was a 2-3-story place, and, you know, had about 3 acres of ground, and Jack leased it, and what he did was he leased it, and then he made apartments made a big rooming house out of it, basically, and then he put these ads in the Pasadena Star News, and he said, offering to rent rooms, but they had to be women of immoral character and weird, strange, anyone who was weird, strange, and you had to be an atheist, you couldn't believe in God, and you, and in other words, the ads automatically irritated the town fathers, you know, these hats. So he collected in the parsonage, as they called it. Of course, they also called it the Ghastly Gables, too. But he collected a really, really weird entourage. Oh, yes, these were before the beatniks and before the hippies. These were really the bohemians. He filled up his house with bohemian tenants, and Wilford Smith was in there, and Jack was married. Jack was married to this gal Helen, and so Jack's embraced the law of Thelema, and Wilford is doing the Gnostic Mass every. They were doing it for a while. They were doing it every day, and Jack's going to live the lifestyle, and he's running this crazy place, and some of the stories that are just so bizarre and so delightful. And we'll get into the Pasadena play, Pasadena Babylon. They did it. Caltech. We'll get into that in a little while, but this was just a delightful, crazy bunch of characters. It would make a sitcom that would run forever. I mean, it was really wild. But things started to get out of hand a little bit because living the lifestyle and all this, Wilford Smith. Sort of got a hold of Jack's wife, and Jack was that was kind of all right. So, but Jack then glommed on to his wife's younger sister, and so they were an item. Then he got the younger sister Betty, and then Jack really did fall in love with Betty. He was really in love with Betty, but they were still doing the Hellenic thing. So Crowley, meanwhile, gets all upset about this. I don't know why Crowley was so upset about it. Crowley was over in England, of course. You understand? Now Crowley and Parsons never physically met. They corresponded back and forth all the time, but they never physically met. And so Crowley was thinking that maybe he better get rid of Wilford Smith. And so the only way he figured he could do it would be to do a horoscope on Smith and then interpret the horoscope in such a way that Smith was going to become a god. So he wrote Smith and he said, you're going to become a god. You have to go off and have a retreat for several months and just get out of there and just go off all by yourself and have a retreat and manifest your godhead. And that was Crowley's way of getting Smith out of there. Because he was worried about Smith was going to wreck things or ruin things. So Smith did exactly that. His friend Leffingwell, he fixed, and Culling, they both fixed up a place for Smith to go retreat and but then Helen went with him. But that was okay with Jack, because Jack was happy with Betty at that point. But then Ron Hubbard comes in. Now, this gets a little sensitive here, and we don't really want to get too deep into this, but you can read all about this in the books and accounts on this. The book that we're primarily referring to tonight is called Sex and Rockets, which came out in 1999 from Farrell House. And this is written by a fellow who calls himself John Carter, who is obviously a high-ranking officer in the OTO. And this is our... There is another book, by the way, that came out just a month before Sex and Rockets, another book called Strange Angel on Parsons. Now, our preference, far and away, our preference is the book Sex and Rockets. This is the one we're recommending. Because it's written by a magician, and you can't write a book about somebody like Jack Parsons and do justice to him unless you are a magician. You have to because so much of this, Jack's magic was just as important in as far as we're concerned, at least, it's just as important as his work with the rocketry. And by the way, John Carter does a very, very good job describing Jack's work with rocketry. I mean, so he balanced it out. He's got, I think that'll satisfy, I'm not a rocket scientist, but I think you'll be satisfied with, well, if you're of a technical bent, I think there's enough, there are enough formulas and schematics and plans and accounts and everything in there about the rocketry to satisfy you. But there are also, in Sex and Rockets, there are very accurate, detailed, and I believe understandable descriptions of Jack's magic, and which I don't believe you're going to find in the book Strange Angel. Strange Angel is written for, the way I understand it, and I haven't read Strange Angel yet. I ordered it, but it hasn't gotten here yet. But from what I gather from the reviews, Strange Angel is for people who aren't particularly interested in magic and maybe not that interested in how to build rockets either. And you see, it's more of a, you know, mainstream kind of a book. But for us, and even for those who, who are not that interested, if you don't understand the rocketry and the magic, then you really don't understand Jack Parsons. I might mention that the same thing applies to a book that Alec Howe wrote on the Golden Dawn called The Magicians of the Golden Dawn. Alec Howe was a fine historian, but not a magician, and therefore his book on the Golden Dawn is, I think, quite lacking, because he doesn't understand what it was that these people were trying to do and what they did accomplish. He doesn't understand that. All he's interested in is who, what, when, and why, and who was married to who, and that sort of thing. As I said, this is John Carter's book Sex and Rockets, 1999, from Farrell House. I highly recommend it. Now, I also mentioned here in the abstract that we are also referring to our own conversations with Lou Culling and Cameron Parsons, and our own 1976 Seventh Ray publication of Parsons' Freedom as a Two-Edged Sword. Now, let me explain all of that. Lewis Culling, was a member of the Agape Lodge. And, in fact, Lewis Culling was directly responsible for Crowley finding out about what was going on with all this soap opera that was going on between Hubbard and Parsons and Betty, and what that was that here after Wilford Smith ran off with Helen and left Parsons with the younger sister, which he fell in love with, Betty, and then Hubbard comes along and he gets Betty all latched up with him, and leaves Jack without a girl, and Jack, tries to rationalize it by saying, oh, well, you know, we're doing the Thelema thing, we can't bind anybody with love and all that sort of stuff, you know, and whatever, and he tries to make the best of it. Crowley, meanwhile, is being informed of all of this, and Crowley is getting upset about it. Now, Lou Culling was the one who wrote Crowley and told him that all this was going on. Now, this resulted, of course, in Crowley taking some action, and it also, I might mention, if you've seen the movie Crowley, this film Crowley, which is rather good. It's kind of, you know, wild and crazy, but it's very well done. And in the beginning of the movie Crowley, John Slaughter plays old Crowley, and he's up in his little walk-up cold water flat, you know, and he's in his dressing gown, and he's opening his letter, and he gets his letter here, and he says, "Oh, I have a letter from my Californian lodge," and he opens it up, and he starts reading it, and he says, and first thing he says, "Where's the money?" And of course, no money in it, and then he starts reading the letter, and he says, "My Californian lodge is being taken over by a writer of science fiction." Well, that was Cummings' letter. And anyway, that resulted in Crowley, the lodge broke up, of course, as a result of all this. And that resulted, of course, in Crowley telling Lou Culling that Lou Culling then requested, after the lodge broke up, he requested a charter for an autonomous low-teal lodge that he would start. And Crowley wrote back and said, "You can do that when you're ready to accept the full responsibility." Well, okay. And Culling sat on that for a while. And then finally, you know, did a few things like the Thule MacLeod thing or another. Finally turned this... when McMurtry was trying to offer us a charter, which, frankly, we weren't going to take anyway, and this was in 1971, so Culling wrote us a charter based on Crowley's letter, and we used that to establish the Collegium of the OTO out of the Blue Equinox, which was kind of an independent thing. And meanwhile, Gerald York had sent us all of Parsons' papers, Cameron letters. We had the Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword. We had the Witchcraft. We had all these essays and everything. We had the whole business. And so we decided not to be Thelemic, but we still had the charter, and we had this little collegium. So in 1976, we published Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword. And we did this in our little magazine, of Seventh Ray. Now, we showed some of that on the Internet. We showed you some pages and some artwork from that. And then, after that, we did that. And we decided some years later, my gosh, it was, about 87 or... But let's get Cameron to write us a preface and maybe help us out and whatever. So we got a hold of Cameron, and that was Jack's widow. And she came over one evening. We had a long chat with her, and she told us a few things, very interesting things. I'll get back to that in a minute. But the gist of it was that she didn't want to work with us. She wanted to work with some of the OTO people. So they came out with a very nice version of Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword. How much of our editing they used, I don't know. But, I mean, they did. They came out with a very nice version of Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword, which Falcon Press published in 1999. And that's available right now on Amazon. You can get it. Now, I want to say right now that we are not going to republish Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword. We probably could if we wanted to, but we're not going to because they've got that out and they did a nice job with it. And what we will do in the forthcoming Seventh Ray, we will show you some, you know, excerpts like we showed on the Internet this evening. We'll show you some excerpts from the original. We'll have an article on it, but we will not. No, we're not going to republish the whole thing. So I recommend, I strongly recommend that you get Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword from Falcon Press, and you can get that, you can get that on Amazon right now. Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword is Jack Parsons' major work. It's his essay, and we're going to read some of that to you. And the reason why we are, and we're going to talk about, we have to talk about a couple of things to really get this across from our standpoint, from a hermetic standpoint. We need to discuss the Babylon working, what it was really intended to do, how it really worked, because there's all kinds of off-the-wall speculations about what the Babylon working was, what it was supposed to do, and all of that, which we'll also get into later. But what it really was intended for, and what it really accomplished. Now, the Babylon working was, to describe it in the shortest terms possible, it was Enochian sex magic. Now, sex magic is not really a part of Enochian work, but it can be. Because basically sex magic, various types of sex magic can be used to just about charge any, to supercharge any type of magical operation, just about. So how this came about and how it worked is this. And all of this, by the way, this is the reason why, one of several reasons why Sex and Rockets is the book you should get on Parsons, because it's written by a magician, and he knows what it's all about. And so consequently, if you really want to understand what Parsons accomplished in this area, and why and how and what the result was, then you need to read this one. And the other one is just for people who, just want to read about how weird he was. It's fine. I'm sure the other book is good, but we are interested here on the Hermetic Hour in magic and in the philosophical and the practical aspects of it. So, the Babylon working is Enochian sex magic, and what the intention was that Jack Frater Balerion, Frater 210 at that time too, he wanted to manifest Babylon. And now Babylon is the Scarlet Woman, or the High Priestess in the Book of the Law, and she's derived from the harlot that rides on the back of the beast from the Book of Revelations, the Great Harlot. Now, if you want to get cynical about this, you can say, well, this was Crowley's masturbation fantasy when he was a kid, because all he was allowed to read was the Book of Revelations and his progress. And so when he got to be in puberty, that was. So Crowley based his religion, so to speak, on the Book of Revelations, in a sense. And so, but Jack had a different concept of the Scarlet Woman and of Babylon than Crowley did. Crowley's approach was very patriarchal. The solar phallic aspect was primary, and this was the Aeon of Horus. And the Scarlet Woman was a vessel, and that was all, essentially. So Crowley wanted the woman to be as lascivious and as brazen as possible, and he said, of course, that in the Scarlet Woman, to whom all power is given, but it was power to be used by the beast, and it was so. Crowley's concept was primarily patriarchal and primarily male-oriented. In fact, I know there are going to be some Thelemites who are going to disagree with me on this, but Crowley's attitude toward women was that they're useful. They're useful. They're useful. But they're more symbolic than actual personalities. This is the symbol and the vessel for the lust, for the great holy lust of man. This is Crowley's idea, I think. This is my reading of it. But Jack was a lover of women, and Jack wanted a goddess. Granted, a lascivious amoral goddess, yes, and you know, a very sexy goddess. Oh yeah, but still, Jack wanted a goddess. He really did. He loved his mother, and maybe he loved her a little too much. I don't know, but Jack wanted a goddess. And so his idea of manifesting Babylon was that she was going to be a savior. She was going to come like Jesus. And I don't know, that sounds a little Freudian, doesn't it? Oh, I'm sorry. She was going to arrive. She was going to be the avatrix. This is what he wanted, and this is what he wanted to do. And this is, and the most important thing I can say here about this, what Jack Parsons did was he germinated magically, astrally, and created this preform. He brought about the American pagan movement, especially with its feminine orientation, which, of course, eventually went a little too far, I think. But still, this is what Jack brought about. And he did this right after World War II, and what he did was he did it on the air tablet, no kidding, and he did it eighth degree, which is onistic. And now, wasn't anything homosexual involved in this? Now, that's another thing I want to dispel. Hubbard was the scribe, but Jack was charging talisman, and he did this for, gosh, about 11 days straight. And then, when they kind of finished, he and Ron took off for the desert just to get the heck out and get some fresh air. And he took off to the Mojave for a day or so. And he came back, and this gal Candy shows up. Just gotten out of the Navy, and she was, pretty, kind of loose and easy. And she got up, and she said, "Well, somebody told me I ought to come over here." And Parsons looked at her, and he said, "Oh, boy, there's my elemental." So he got her right in, and I don't know how quickly they got her clothes off, but they got her right in. So he starts the second phase of this thing, and Ron's still scribing, and he starts doing a ninth degree with Cameron. And, and this is going, and the same, essentially the same situation, and Cameron she got to thinking that she was going to be Babylon, but that's not what was really going on. Jack was using her as, in this sense, he was using her as his partner in a ninth degree, right, to go ahead and still to manifest this great avatrix that was coming, Babylon, who was going to liberate everybody. And this was going to be the Fred Adams had Corey, the maiden savioress, and Jack, before that, he was going to have Babylon, the courtesan savioress. Let me just read you just a little bit out of the Woman Girt with the Sword. That's the fourth chapter of Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword here, just to show you how he was with this whole thing. "It is to you, woman, beautiful redeemer race, whom I address this chapter. That which stirs in you now is not madness, not sin, not folly, but life. This new life is the joy and the fire that will begin a new race, create a new heaven and a new earth. When you were a child, did not the wind and the sun speak to you? Did you not hear the mountain's voice, the voice of the river, the storm? Have you not heard the whisper of the stars and the ineffable voice in silence? Have you not gone naked in the forest with the wind on your body and felt the caresses of Pan? Your heart has swollen spring, blossomed with summer, and saddened with winter. These things are the covenant, and in them is the truth that is forever." And I'm going to skip down here a little bit. It is to you who are the redeemer from sin and sorrow, from guilt and shame. Woman, O splendor incarnate, how long have you served in chains, a slave to the lust and guilt of pigs? How long have you writhed under the degradation of lust, of your holy name, whore, or suffered silently under the degradation called virginity and virtue? How well have you known the stake, the rock, the whip, the chains, the imprisonment, and even the entombment in the service of your master? And was the bond fear? Was it weakness? Was it cowardice or inferiority? O shame of man, it was none of these. It was love. A man once crucified in a redemption that failed. Yet if 10 times 10 million men were crucified, this infamy could not be redeemed. Husband, father, priest, jailer, judge, executioner, exploiter, seducer, destroyer, so has your lover mastered and defiled you. Yet pity him, for he sought love. But finally there is an end, and then the beginning of all the future will be with you, for you are the mother of a new race, the redeemer and lover of the new men, the men who shall be free. Okay, now there you see the beginning of goddess-oriented neo-paganism in the United States, in America. That's it right there. Now, this is what's important in what Jack did. He did this. He produced this on the astral, and it did work, and it worked amazingly well. And you know, this is, so I say, this is the sort of thing that you have to be a magician to understand what it was he was trying to do, and how he accomplished it. Now, on the other hand, there is an article in the Green Egg that by Alan Greenfield, and I'm not criticizing the article, but some of the wild speculations about the Babylon working have come down, which in a way I kind of like them because I'm kind of an old shit. This sort of appeals a little bit, but let me just read this right quick here, so you get how wild this thing can get here. All right, it says here, Hubbard almost certainly used his considerable charismatic and hypnotic ability to implant Parsons with a bogus chapter 4 of the Book of the Law, but he could not resist having his signature all over it in terms of his name, ideas, and motives encrypted in the Euphonaut cipher, and he probably learned the cipher from his pulp magazine, Occultist Connections. Elsewhere, I have demonstrated that Ray Palmer and Richard Shaver were using the cipher or something much like it throughout the 1940s in the pages of Amazing Stories and Elsewhere. You know, as I said, there's some synchronicities there, but primarily the Babylon working, this was the purpose of it, and it really did accomplish that purpose. Now, Jack, getting close to time. Jack died, unfortunately, and after the Hubbard thing, and Hubbard ran off with his girl and I'm not going to get into all of that business, but you can read about that. But Jack fell on bad times, and the Molina thing came back to bite him, and he lost his security clearance. Well, you can't do very much in aerospace in Los Angeles. I know I was in aerospace for years. You can't, you know, if you don't have a security clearance, you're dead in the water. So Jack decided that he would try to go elsewhere where he'd be more appreciated. And he made a deal with the Mexican government, and they were going to open up a factory and a lab for him down there. And he had a new explosive that he was working on. And so he and Cameron were getting set to drive to Mexico, and they had her all packed up and ready to go. This time, of course, they weren't living in the old house. That was gone. They were living in a smaller place right down the road from, a much smaller place right down the road from where the old place had been. And they were getting all ready to go, and Candy went off to the store to get some last-minute supplies. And Jack and his mother, Jack's mother, Ruth, was living with him, but she was off somewhere at some friends. And Jack was, he told Cameron that he had a few things to get ready in the lab, and he had a huge explosion in the lab, and he was killed. And of course, he his arm blown off, and a big hole in his jaw. It was really an awful thing. And so that's still kind of a mystery. What was it? That, you know, was it murder? Was it an accident? Was it a conspiracy? And what was it? You know, and there's a lot of speculation about this. Most people, you know, reasonably think it was an accident. However, it's interesting enough that a crooked cop that Jack had been a witness against many years before World War II, this crooked cop had car bombed another crooked cop. Jack testified, as an explosives expert, testified against this guy and had him sent him to prison. And this guy had just gotten out on parole just a couple of days before Jack died. So there's some suspicion there that maybe that might be it. Cameron believed the CIA had done it. It was what she told me. But, I don't think, Lou Culling told me what the formula was for the stuff that Jack was trying to mix up. And I'm not going to repeat that formula because, you know, I don't want anybody trying to do this. But from what Lou Culling told me, I can understand why it might have happened. And right after that happened, you know, within hours, Jack's mother, Ruth, committed suicide, and because she couldn't live without Jack. And so this was, oh boy, this was a really tragic end to the whole thing. I got to mention one more thing before we find out. Well, two more things. There is a novel based upon, it was written back in 1942, published back in 1942, is a novel called Rocket to the Morgue by Anthony Boucher, who was a science fiction writer and a mystery writer, is also Philip K. Dick's agent, who knew all these people in the LASPAS, because Jack was one of the LASPAS, Los Angeles Science Fiction Association, Science Fiction Club members. And so Anthony Boucher wrote this novel, Rocket to the Morgue, which Dave Finnan got me a copy of here. And this is, a lot of people have fun trying to figure out who is who on this thing. So you can read the novel, and then you can find on the internet, you can find all the characters, the different characters, including Jack Parsons and Ron Hubbard and everyone that are listed in the novel. And that's kind of an inside thing to do. And the other thing we want to mention, of course, is Pasadena Babylon, the play the drama that the Caltech Theater Arts Department put on 2 years ago. And this is really, really a terrific play. We really, really enjoyed this thing. And the way they did Crowley in the play, because Crowley and Jack and Crowley never personally met, so they would have Crowley up on this balcony with a spectral spotlight on him, and he would look down on the parsonage, you know, and what was going on down there in the living room of the parsonage from this ethereal balcony position, and he would come out in his dressing gown, and he'd look down, and he'd say, "Oh, Jack, you must follow your true will, Jack. and Jack, send the money.
It was really good, and they even had they even staged Jack driving, jetting up the storm with the Barzabel operation, and driving Ron and Betty back into port. They even staged that, and they did a beautiful job, bud. I think that the whole story of Jack Parsons and what he accomplished both in rocketry and of course in magic is very, very, very well worth reading. And here again, as I say, I recommend Adam Parfrey. You did a great job publishing that book, and that's Sex and Rockets. And Sex and Rockets and Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword from Falcon. Be sure and get that. And, you know, Jack Parsons is one of the great figures in magic in the Western world, but especially in the United States, and a terrific scientist. And so, next week we'll be back with, I think we'll do Carl Jung next week. We'll do Carl Jung, and we'll dip into the Great Red Book, and we'll do. And meanwhile, have a good evening and good magic.